friends, hope you've all been well. Well, I am unwell, because I just came back from a 3, but so fun weeks of vacation. I am so jet-lagged. It's Tuesday right now. I arrived back in New York Sunday afternoon, welcomed by the first snow of the year. And then I went to work the whole day as a nurse yesterday, Monday. Anyways, regarding my vacation, I went to LA to spend Thanksgiving with my dad's side of the family. Then I went to Manila in the Philippines to spend time with my mom's side of the family ahead of Christmas. And then I went to Seoul, South Korea for a hot minute. Literally 4.5 days just to, of course, eat everything, see some friends. And also so grateful to meet with several Korean beauty, skincare, and cosmetic brands to hear more about their stories, their product philosophy, meet with their global marketing teams who are all so kind and welcoming, and also get free products. Oh, I am so grateful to live this life. One exciting meetup was with the brand Dr. Rejual, a PDRN skincare company. And if you don't know what PDRN means, make sure you listen to our 8th episode of this 4th season with Dr. Lana Chuk. We talk all about it. Anyways, one of the most unforgettable parts of my Korea trip was when the Dr. Rejual team made a billboard for me in the middle of Gangnam Square. Wow, my heart was so full and continues to be full. I still can't wrap my head around it. Such a dream. I remember spending most, if not all of my teenage years in high school hiding my face because of my acne, to now having my face blasted in front of the world to see. My inner child is truly healed. And this is why I love skincare so much, and why we have a consecutive 4-episode section of this new season of the podcast. Because skincare not only changed my skin, it changed my life and how I viewed myself and the world around me. And this leads us to the last portion of the 4-episode skincare era. And I must say, this might be the most crucial episode of all 4 because we break down skincare in itself to its most atomic units. Literally. The science behind it all. Skincare is so exciting, especially nowadays, because there's so many products that can literally cater to any skin concern that you may have. But at the same time, I think it's also a double-edged sword to have so much skincare around because it leads us to the question, which ones really work? Which ones really do what they promise? And with many enticing claims like hypoallergenic, non-comedogenic, fragrance-free, dermatologically tested, paraben-free, reef-safe sunscreen. Honestly though, do all of these claims have any bearing at all? Should we listen to fear-mongering claims online regarding the demonization of certain cosmetic brands, products, and ingredients? Well, let's face the fact, literally. Today, with the best expert guest I personally believe we can hear from in this domain of cosmetic science. I am a huge, huge fan of our guest. I am so honored that she has been so generous with sharing her time, knowledge, and expertise with us today. Let's welcome cosmetic science communicator, Dr. Michelle Wong, also known as Lab Muffin Beauty Science, who has amassed over 1.5 million followers online by educating the public about the science behind beauty products and ingredients. Dr. Wong is a chemistry PhD from the University of Sydney, has a diploma of personal care formulation from Personal Care Science, and is the author of The Science of Beauty and the Lab Muffin Guide to Basic Skincare. She also co-founded BeautySciComm, an online initiative to increase the quality, volume, and the reach of accurate beauty science content today. And Dr. Wong is truly a trusted voice, featured as a media expert on the New York Times, The Atlantic, HuffPost, Daily Mail, ABC News, Elle France in Canada, Well and Good, The Cut, and so much more. I am so honored. This is such a dream. Okay, let's get to it. Sometimes, it's not time that heals all wounds, but flowers, steeped gently into a cup of tea. Inspired by founder Lisa Lee's own healing journey from thyroid disease and burnout, the Chi is a wellness brand based in New York City on a mission to help people feel more joy, calm, and connection through the power and beauty of flowering teas. The Chi was born from the discovery of rare, single-origin whole flower teas rooted in centuries-old Eastern rituals. Each bloom is hand-picked at peak vitality by small family-owned farms across Asia, to offer a grounding, sensorial experience that reconnects you to yourself, one cup at a time. Choose from the Shangri-La Rose, Blue Lotus, and the Royal Chrysanthemum and get 15% off at the-chi.com. That's the-chi.com with the code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. One-time use and cannot be combined with other codes. Drink flowers, feel alive.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Friends of France podcast. And today I am so excited and so honored to introduce to you our expert and special guest for today. You guys can't see it in the video, but I have a Bible next to me right now. The author of The Science of Beauty, chemistry PhD, science communicator, author, and icon, Dr. Michelle Wong. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to talk to you.
My goodness, this all came with your years of education and years of experience within, you know, chemistry and the field of beauty. I wanted to know, how did you get to this space and how did you get here in the world of beauty, of chemistry? And I guess what led to Lab Muffin Beauty Science?
Yeah, I guess it's a bit weird, but also I think it's quite typical for like someone with my background. So I live in Australia and my parents are immigrants. They're Asian, obviously. They came from Hong Kong. So when I was a kid, I was always told, don't worry about makeup, don't worry about skincare, just focus on your studies, don't wear makeup. Yeah, so once I got to uni, I suddenly was allowed to wear makeup and suddenly I was like, okay, well, I'm looking at all this stuff and I don't know what's going on. And also at the same time, back in school, I was actually more into things like arts and drama. But then, of course, my parents were like, you should study something useful. So I did chemistry as like my extra science subject. I got really good marks in school. So in Australia, we have this system where like based on what mark you get, that tells you what courses you can get into. And like I had enough marks to do the highest course, which was law, combined law with something else. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of English. So I'll combine it with science because then that seems more useful than art. So I started doing science and law. When I started working in a law firm, I realized I just couldn't do it. My law firm was representing like a tobacco company. And so I would have to go through all these emails where clearly the company knew that their cigarettes were causing lung cancer. And it was just going through all these emails. And I was like, what am I doing with my life? Why am I helping these people? From a legal perspective, yes, yeah. Everyone deserves representation. It's just someone else. So I focused more on the science. So I was using these products and I was like, how do they actually work? What does this actually mean? All this stuff about brightening. What is brightening from like a molecular level? I was doing medicinal chemistry, which is very much, you know, how substances interact with your body and have an effect. So I was like, how does the skincare cream have an effect? Like, I should be able to know what receptors it's hitting, how it's getting into skin. I have all this knowledge. And so I started diving into it. And this was back in 2011. Actually, before 2011, I think it was 2 years before I started realizing, like, I'm finding all this stuff out and I should really write it down somewhere because I have a terrible memory. Plus, I think other people must also be asking the same question. So that's how I started Lab Muffin. And so I guess I've been doing this for, since 2011. So it's been about 14 years. Yeah, amazingly still going.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting how you go from law to now chemistry, and it gets more into the science of beauty. But I think you still have that edge of law in you because you bring judgment, I guess, in this domain of so much misinformation, right? When it comes to the space of beauty, of skincare, of cosmetics. Throughout high school, I had severe acne, like so bad. Like, I didn't want to leave the house. During my birthdays, my mom would be like, oh, what do you want for your birthday? I'm like, just bring me to the dermatologist, let me get a steroid shot, I don't know, let me get a new prescription for tretinoin. I guess during that time, I guess the bigger brands here was like Proactiv. I don't know if you have it in Australia.
Yeah,
and I guess during that time I was so overwhelmed with so much information of what I should be using in my skin, what I shouldn't be using, specifically within the context of my acne prone skin. But fast forward to years later, and I guess in this domain that we have now, oh my gosh, I think it got even more complicated. You talk about this in your book a lot regarding topics and buzzwords that are so prevalent. I feel like you hear in every commercial. You swipe up TikTok or Instagram and you would hear some of these words. So I wanted to kindly ask for your expertise and just briefly go through some of these buzzwords that you call marketing buzzwords. Like, what do they mean? What's your general thoughts about them? Because I'll be honest, some of these words before I'm like, oh, I have to avoid this. I have to not use this. I think the first one is hypoallergenic. What does this actually mean?
Yeah, like one of the reasons I really hate these marketing buzzwords is because there's no real definition. And so they mean something different to everyone. And a lot of the time, this also means legally and also from a brand point of view. So when a brand slaps hypoallergenic on their product, a lot of the time it just means they've looked up a list of common allergens and it doesn't have those allergens in them. So things like lanolin, for example, is a really common allergen that comes from sheep. The better definition, like the better brands, the ones who do more work. They will actually test them on a bunch of people with sensitive skin and see if they have reactions. But yeah, a lot of the time it is just, in theory, it doesn't have those ingredients. But in reality, there will probably be someone allergic to every ingredient or like traces of impurities in those ingredients. So it's never a guarantee, but I guess it does help with the chances of having a reaction.
I see. How about dermatologically tested? I feel like we hear this all the time now. Dermatologists reviewed, dermatologists tested. What does this all mean? And does it hold any bearing for you?
Honestly, it doesn't mean that much. So in theory, dermatologically tested should mean that it's tested on skin. A lot of the time, it should mean it's been tested under the supervision of a dermatologist. But in reality, it's a bit of a question mark. Dermatologists recommend it. This one is pretty shifty because I heard from a dermatologist that at a conference, they got passed a survey around and they were like, would you recommend this product? Yes or no? And they just ticked it and then they collected it. And that became the basis of a dermatologist recommended claim on a product, which, I mean, if you were sitting at a conference and let's say they paid for your lunch, like you would probably tick yes, just, you know. And also, I guess, like as a normal person, if you get a bunch of products and they seem okay, you would probably tick yes rather than no, right? So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I hear that all the time. And sometimes it makes me wonder, is there conflict of interest going around this buzzword? Because, you know, we see, I guess, especially in the terrain now of social media, we see a lot of dermatologists who partner with brands, different skincare brands. And it makes you wonder if there is, let's say, a survey passed around. I'm sure they will say yes or whatnot, right? Okay, this next one, this is probably the story of my life given my background in acne, non-comedogenic. Oh my gosh, I think I remember going through this website, which is kind of like, I guess, the Yuka app now. I feel like several years ago, there was this website where you could check if an ingredient is comedogenic or non-comedogenic. And they're like, you have acne? You can't do this product. What does non-comedogenic actually mean?
Again, in theory, there's a lot of in theories. In theory, it means if it's non-comedogenic, it shouldn't clog pores. But in reality, we have tons of oils and other substances on our skin. How that interacts with a random cosmetic product, a product which has a ton of ingredients in different ratios, how that complex mixture interacts, it's really variable. So you can't really make that claim. The way they usually make that claim is they've tested that ingredient on its own on rabbit ears. So this is back in the day when animal testing was a big thing. These days, there's barely any animal testing. And so they were tested on the ears, and rabbit ears have big pores and they get clogged up easily. And so if they had big pores there after trying that, then they would say, yes, it's comedogenic. But that's so different from putting it on your face. When it's really diluted, most ingredients in a product are going to be way under 5%. So yeah, how that interacts with your skin, I mean, we all know someone who just uses whatever on their face and it's clear and perfect. So there's a lot of individual variation, like the oils you put out, if you're acne prone, which I am as well, they're actually the things that mostly clog your skin. So it's like, on its own, your skin is already really clog prone. If you add anything to the mix, who knows? So yeah, I guess like, in theory, again, it should be less likely to cause clogged pores. In reality, you can't really just tell just from that label.
Yeah, and I agree with your note that there's some people who just put whatever on their skin. And I have friends who literally use bar soap on their face. And I'm like, how do you have clear skin? This is so unfair. The next one. My goodness, this is a big one too. Paraben-free. What are parabens?
Parabens are preservatives. So when you have a cosmetic product, most of them are based on water. They've got tons of water and sort of like food, they just go off. I mean, they're sitting on your shelf for months. If you have like really watery food, even if you have like a glass of tea, like you can see that go moldy after a while. So yeah, like you need preservatives in there to stop the mold from growing, from bacteria from growing. If you have that growing, then you put it on your skin. In the past, there's been under-preserved products and they can cause eye infections. If you're immunocompromised, it can cause like really bad infections. I think there's a whole bunch of babies who are really badly injured, possibly died from this kind of thing. So it's a very big risk. And so parabens and other preservatives are added to it to control this microbial growth. Now, parabens, they are very effective at this, and they were very commonly used for a long time. And so if there's nothing commonly used, that's what's going to be studied. Researchers are going to say, if we can test any product, we're going to test the ones that are common. And so in the literature, there's actually a whole bunch of studies where they've tested parabens on cells, on animals. They've checked for traces in people's blood, that kind of thing. And so there's all this very scary looking data. And then there's a lot of apps that say things like, Parabens are nasty because of this. They're dirty. Use this other ingredient instead, which has a lot less data. And the main reason it has less data isn't because it's safer, it's just less studied. So parabens are actually some of the most studied ingredients. We know exactly where they're safe compared to other ingredients. I mean, we'll never know exactly. Scientists hate certainty. We hate committing to things, so we'll never really know for sure, but it's a lot more sure than a lot of these newer preservatives. So paraben-free is really a buzzword. There's nothing wrong with parabens compared to all the other things you could be using. But yeah, unfortunately, it seems like parabens are just so maligned that people are not going to use them anymore. And it's a big problem because some of the alternatives are much more allergenic. A lot of them are worse for sensitive skin. There were two ingredients, two preservatives, MI and MCI, and they were used in a lot of products. It seems like they might have replaced parabens. It's hard to say, but they were increasing in use around the same time. And they weren't really tested as well for allergy. And it turns out they're really good at causing allergies. So I think it's something like 5 or 10% of the population might be allergic to them. I'm allergic to them, which is why I'm really mad about this. But yeah, they're in tons of shampoos still. They're in laundry detergent. So for example, if I wash my laundry with the wrong detergent, I'll just be itchy in my clothes all day. And this is actually something that, every time I talk about this in a video, I get comments saying like, oh my God, I think this is what's wrong with me. But yeah, so this is what happens when we phase out an ingredient that looks scary, but isn't actually that scary. We end up with, you know, very real impacts.
Yeah. And I feel like there's also several people like, I don't want any preservatives at all, even if it's an alternative. And I'm like, I would please love to have some preservatives on my cosmetics if I'm putting them on my skin, please. Yeah, I feel like fear mongering, I feel like it offers a quote unquote safer and more pleasurable solution. In turn, it's actually much worse and exacerbates whatever they're fighting against, right?
Not to get all topical, but I think this is one of the things that I noticed when I first started. I was also reading a lot about vaccines at the time, because I think this is like around 2007 or something. I was in the lab, I was doing a lot of experiments. There's a lot of waiting time. So I was like reading a lot of blogs, which were the big thing then. And there were all these like cases of measles rising, which, you know, history repeats itself.
Yep.
But yeah, it was because people were scared of vaccines because they seem scary. And so, you know, measles, I guess, quote unquote, natural, seems really safe in comparison to, you know, stabbing a needle into your tiny baby and having it cry a lot. So yeah, I think it's pretty much the same thing. Like a lot of the time, like not doing something seems safer than doing something, but it does actually, you know, measurably prevent a lot of worse effects.
Yeah, you know, and as a nurse, I do work in public health during the seasons of immunization, which is kind of now, it's flu season here. And it's very interesting to me that every season still, we get these vaccine skeptics or even anti-vaxxers at these programs. And they're like, oh, it's not natural. What is one person even said, yeah, what's natural is the flu. So it might be better if I'm, you know, introduced to it and I get my immunity from exposure. And they're like, because natural is better. I'm like, say that to someone, you know, who stepped on poison ivy, which is straight from nature. So it's very interesting how, I guess, the extent of fear mongering, the waves it can lead up to. And I think the other term that I guess has made waves a lot online and even on, you know, those good old Reddit forums is when it comes to fragrances. And obviously, we're not talking about like fragrances as perfumes, like in itself that we spray on ourselves, but I feel like fragrances embedded in cosmetics and in skincare in itself. Now, we always hear fragrance-free. Is fragrance really something to be feared of?
Yes and no. Okay, so if you are allergic to common fragrances, then yes, you should probably avoid fragrance. You should go fragrance-free. It's a lot safer. So I guess the thing is fragrance, there's so many fragrance ingredients, and a single fragrance in a product, it's going to just have a tiny selection of these fragrance ingredients in it. If you're allergic to some fragrance ingredients, you're not going to be allergic to all of them. So in theory, if you are allergic to fragrances, there will be fragranced products you will be completely fine with. I guess the tricky bit though, for people who are allergic, is that you can't really tell because they will just say fragrance. And that's because humans are not perfectly objective creatures. Like none of us are objective. When we try a product, in every consumer study, the first thing people do is they look at the texture and they smell it. This is just straight facts. Can't avoid this. People care about how their products smell. And if the product has a particular smell, they'll evoke memories. I did a fragrance course actually because it's so interesting. The fragrance center, like it's connected to memory. And so it's really, really powerful as one of our senses. And so this sort of power, like companies don't want to share this with other companies. They don't want to teach them their secrets. And so that's why it's all hidden under the word fragrance. But for people with fragrance allergies, this is really annoying because then you can't tell what's in it. You can't tell which fragrance products are safe or not. But yeah, so fragrance allergy, quote unquote, is really common, but fragrance is such a big umbrella that a lot of people think they're allergic to things that they aren't, and it seems like the risk is bigger. I know some dermatologists used to say just avoid fragrances because the risk of allergy is too high, but it's not really that high. I think a lot of the time doctors will say that because they see the worst of the worst.
Yeah.
They're not going to have a true sampling of the population. Mm-hmm. So I think population-wise, it's like maybe 1% or 2% of people are allergic to fragrances. And I think, yeah, in skincare, it's not a problem unless you're allergic, like wearing fragrances. I do think it would be nice if skincare was like less fragranced because it's quite annoying sometimes. I do avoid some products that smell too strong. Yeah, it's just like, you know, a little bit. I like the Korean level of fragrance.
Yes.
American level of fragrance. I didn't really understand the fragrance haters until I went to the US because in Australia, people, like most companies treat us as part of Asia Pacific. So we usually get the Asian versions of products. And when I went to the US, like, wow, your stuff is fragranced. I can understand the hate. I would also be really mad about fragrance if I lived there. But yeah.
Yeah, no, there's some products here where, you know, obviously I read their ingredients or I guess the reviews of the customers. I'm like, this must be a good product for me to try. And then I get a whiff of it and I'm like, whoa, I don't know. And I agree with you with the whole Korean skincare. There is some sort of smell, but it's not as like as strong as we have it here in America. Because here, I feel like you could walk into the store and I can immediately tell, oh, this is the product that's standing on the shelf. Well, speaking of walking inside a store, I want to take us into walking inside, I guess, a doctor's office. And along the front desk, you'll see a shelf of so many products and they will tell you it's medical grade skincare. Like, this is the luxe of the luxe of skincare. It's so good because it's medical grade. And you'll see this a lot online too. People are like, oh yeah, I switched to medical grade skincare. But then I feel like people don't actually know what medical grade skincare means. What does it mean? And again, does it hold any bearing for you?
It doesn't mean much. Yeah, again, it is like a marketing term. A lot of brands that only sell in doctor's offices will call themselves medical grade. But then a lot of brands, they've started selling online, like direct to consumer, and they're still calling themselves medical grade. There's no like regulatory difference. There are limits in a lot of places on the products that they use in the clinic. So things like peels, sometimes those concentrations aren't allowed in consumer products. But with things like cleansers that they sell to you to take home and use, there is no real medical grade. And it's kind of funny because they tend to say when people are trying to sell medical grade products, a lot of the time it is estheticians, they'll call the non-medical grade products like drugstore or OTC, which is over-the-counter. But over-the-counter, that's actually like a higher grade. So most products are cosmetic products. They're like normal. And then over-the-counter, technically, these are actually drug products, things like benzoyl peroxide, sunscreen in the US, where you can buy it and there's like a drug facts label. So that's actually regulated more strictly than medical grade skincare. I guess at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if something is medical grade or not. For me, I really look at how it's been tested, whether or not it uses ingredients that do have evidence behind them. So yeah, like a lot of the, I guess, quote unquote, drugstore skincare that a lot of people pushing medical grade skincare tend to diss, they actually have like massive teams of scientists working on them. So massive brands like L'Oreal and all of like L'Oreal's like mini brands under them, like La Roche-Posay, Cetaphil, all of these, they have so much research going into them, generally much more than a quote unquote medical grade brand.
What if your routine felt less like a chore and more like a ritual? Rooted in Japan since 1946, Uka Beauty creates everyday practices that remind us beauty isn't just how you look, but how you feel. At the heart of their mission is regenerative beauty, from ingredients that restore biodiversity to refillable, circular packaging that reduces waste. Their iconic Scalp Kanzen brush transforms scalp care into full body relief, easing headaches, boosting circulation, and releasing jaw tension. And with innovative shampoos, nail oils, and serums, Uka restores balance and vitality with timeless Japanese sensibility and craftsmanship. Join the mission of turning care into impact. In collaboration with Rom Spa, you can get 15% off your first order at ukabeauty.com. That's ukabeauty.com with the code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. One-time use only and cannot be combined with other codes. We long for what's natural, yet often hide it with layers. And today's soap market is no different, crowded with products that are harsh and overly processed. Born in Seoul, South Korea, Chai Minu was made to bring things back to something simpler, something intentional. Each handcrafted bar of soap is cold processed in small batches, using only natural oils and botanical powders. It is then cured and air dried for over 1,000 hours, letting the bar harden naturally for a gentler feel and a longer life. It all began with a mother searching for relief for her son's sensitive skin and her refusal to settle for harsh liquid soaps or quick-made bars. Such her skin experienced a byproduct of patience, simplicity, and a mother's love. For 15% off at shybinu.com. That's shybinu.com with the code FRANZ. That's FRANZ.
Speaking of testing, I think there was a testing report that came out probably a year or so ago that created a ruckus online. I remember, I feel like, going through Instagram stories, and every story right after each other was about benzene found in this list of sunscreens. And I was like, oh my goodness, what is going on? Like, everyone in the skincare community was like, oh, I have to throw out this sunscreen because it has the benzene on it. And I feel like people were also harping on it. Like, they probably don't even know what benzene is or its implications in their body. It was just labeled as a carcinogen found in these batches of sunscreens. We can't really talk about skincare and beauty unless we talk about sunscreens. And specifically about this topic of benzene, what is this? What's implications in our health? I guess what's the whole connection with the whole testing when it comes to sunscreens?
Yeah, so benzene is, well, first off, it's the structure that you see when you think of chemistry. It's like the hexagon with the circle in the middle, or like the double lines. It is a carcinogen. It's a solvent. Carcinogen means it causes cancer, and it's actually everywhere, which, you know, very reassuring. Kind of like UV, it's everywhere. It causes cancer, but it depends on dose. Like, not everyone exposed to it will end up with cancer, and the cancers it causes are mostly blood cancer, so leukemia. The reason it's everywhere is because it's a petrol additive. So our main source, like the main exposure we get is, for example, when you're filling up your car at the pump. You're in New York, so maybe you don't do this ever, but if you're at the petrol station, you can't afford to keep a car in New York, right?
You can.
I'm sure it's like ridiculous prices. But yeah, like if you smell it, if you have a car parked in the garage attached to your house, then you're going to get these fumes. It's also in tons of other stuff like paint. I think forest fires release it. But yeah, it's everywhere, and it was found in sunscreen. So it's honestly not that surprising that it was found in sunscreen. It's also been found in like hand sanitizer, deodorant, lots and lots of products, because I mean, it is everywhere. It's hard to keep it out. But there were higher levels in there because it was used in one of the, I think, producing one of the ingredients in the product. Also found in benzoyl peroxide recently. So what's behind it? There's this lab called Valleyshaw, and it seems like they are connected to with a whole bunch of class action lawyers. And they have a history of finding scary chemicals in stuff. They found a carcinogen in Zantac. And so if anyone remembers the Zantac with recalls, that was also them. It also turns out that they're not very good at measuring things. Like, it turns out all their measurements have massively exaggerated how much is in the products. We don't really know about benzene yet. So maybe not all yet. But the FDA has released a statement signaling that they've tested the same products and the amounts they found were much lower than Valleyshaw. Don't really know what's going on there. I suspect their testing method produced the benzene itself. But anyway, it's been found in lots of products. The amounts were really low. But Valleyshaw's statements, I would guess it was on purpose for these class action lawsuit reasons, really exaggerated the danger. And I think everyone freaked out because they've never heard of benzene. They don't know what it is. They don't know the real risk. But yeah, the amounts are so low. They are much, much, much less in general than you would get from normal everyday life, just breathing the air. Unless, of course, you do something weird, like, I don't know, huff petrol, that kind of thing. I'm sure there's people in those situations, or like huff sure. like the sunscreen.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just not really a risk if you use it normally.
Yeah, that's good to know. And I guess also within the topic of sunscreen, there is another quote-unquote buzzword. It's kind of linked to sustainability, and it's reef-safe sunscreen. I think a few weeks ago, I was buying sunscreen at the store, and this random person came up to me and was like, you shouldn't buy that. It's not reef-safe. And I'm just there like, oh. Okay, and then she just left. Reef safe sunscreen. I feel like I see this over the forum, see what does this really mean? And is it also just a marketing ploy?
So rude. Why would someone, I don't know. Maybe it's because I live in Sydney and we don't talk to strangers here. We all like, this is like such a tangent, but we have this thing called Chuggers. I think it was about 10 years ago, all the charities started hiring people to come up to you and they're like really friendly and stuff. And they go, hey, how are you? And then suddenly they're like, would you like to donate to like our thing? And so I think after that, everyone in Sydney, like when you walk towards someone, even if, no, they're, exactly. if they're smart, especially if they look friendly, like you just, your eyes go the other way. And so, yeah, there's all these like Reddit threads saying, why is everyone in Sydney so unfriendly? Like, I'm visiting Sydney as a tourist and no one will like make eye contact. And it's like, we have trauma. Anyway, so Rosé sunscreen, yes, it is largely a marketing ploy. There was a study in 2016. Oh, I think it was like technically 2015. Anyway, around that time, there was a study where they claimed that they found sunscreens were hurting coral reefs, but there was a lot of sus stuff around this study. So generally, scientists, you know, you publish a study and then other scientists comment on it, you know, very normal. But this study, they sent out a whole bunch of press releases like the night before the study came out. And so all the media, all the journalists, they already had stories prepared about like, you know, sunscreens are killing coral reefs. And scientists couldn't read the study and comment. So, you know, the journalists couldn't reach out to other scientists and go, hey, do you think this is legit? Like, there's no time for that kind of thing to happen. So this story went everywhere. And yeah, now we have all this reef safe stuff everywhere. I think it was honestly a very good marketing exercise. But if you look at the study, it's really dodge. They've got calculation errors, and they've also got this thing where basically what they did was they dumped sunscreen onto coral, and then they saw how much sunscreen it took to bleach them. And then they also measured the sunscreen amounts in the environment, and they said, oh, actually, the amounts in the environment in some places are higher than the amount needed to bleach them. Except the coral were really stressed in the study. They didn't let them acclimatize, so they were probably going to bleach like much more easily anyway. The measurement they took in the environment, they just took like half a cup from each place and then measured it. Not sure how their measuring techniques were, whether that was accurate. Like, measuring stuff is not that easy, and it doesn't look like they really were good at that. But yeah, lots and lots of sus stuff about it, but it is a big thing now. In reality, later on, the National Academies in America, they got a whole bunch of coral scientists and got them to look at all the data. And they concluded that sunscreens probably don't have a big impact on coral. Like, there's lots of other things that have much more impact, like climate change. And also, even with the different sunscreen ingredients, zinc oxide, everyone says zinc oxide is reef safe. And I think it's oxybenzone and octinoxate are bad for reefs based on that one study. But if you look at the toxicity data, it all completely overlaps. Like, zinc itself, it's not completely safe for the environment. It will hurt coral because, I mean, even though it's technically natural, there's not that much zinc in the environment. Like, natural things can hurt you too. Zinc is technically a heavy metal. So yeah, like, zinc is actually classified as an aquatic toxin. Like, if you look up the safety data sheet, it's got a little diamond symbol with a dead fish on it. So yeah, it's not safe for everything. Depends on dose.
You know, once this episode comes out, I'm going to look for that woman who stopped me in the store and be like, you have to listen to this episode.
Yeah. Show her the dead fish.
Show her the dead fish. Yeah, and the SDS of the whole thing. Yeah, there's so many forums. I feel like I find myself on Reddit sometimes just because I'm so curious of what people think and what people say about all of these things, right? Obviously, I refer to your videos, which are great. And I'm just like, wow, I feel like I'm learning more every day. And can I say, your book, I felt like I was in class every time I went through a page, because it has to be like a canon when it comes to talks, when it comes to beauty and cosmetics. It's so good. And you mentioned about collagen in the book. And oh my goodness, I feel like whenever I go to a vitamin shop here, like, the vitamin shops here are part of like the grocery stores, and you walk by it and there's always a huge box of collagen peptides and serums with claims of like, this will boost your collagen. What are the premise behind all of these products that seek to increase collagen levels or restore the collagen that was lost? And do these products actually help with that?
Yeah, it's hard to say. So collagen is in the lower layer of skin, the dermis. It's kind of like your skin is like a mattress. The lower layer, once it starts losing the collagen peptides, it starts getting like thinner and saggier. And that's how you end up with wrinkles as you get older. So collagen, in terms of supplements, like, I guess the theory behind it was, at the start, was you eat the collagen and you end up with more collagen. But then people realize that doesn't really work that way. But then at the same time, it turns out collagen does have a special amino acid in it. It's like a tiny unique part of the collagen. And It's thought that if you have that, if you have broken down bits of collagen in your blood, then it can signal to your body that the collagen has broken down and you need to make more collagen. So I guess that's the theory. And there are little bits that suggest that that does happen. There are clinical trials that show that there are changes to skin when you take collagen supplements, but a lot of them were funded by skincare companies, so really hard to tell how accurate they are. And the effects weren't that big. So in general, it's like maybe it could do something, but the downsides are collagen supplements are pretty expensive compared to things like sunscreen and tretinoin. So I would say if you're not already wearing sunscreen, using tretinoin or a retinoid, using other skincare products, then probably not worth it. The other big risk is with supplements, especially in the US, there's not much regulation. And so every once in a while you hear things like, you know, there's a whole bunch of supplements and they found lead in a whole bunch of supplements. Sometimes people test supplements and what they say is in there is not in there. So that's the risk you run. I would say just be very careful of that risk. Also, a lot of collagen supplements have other things in them, things like vitamin A, biotin, which can have more severe impacts. I think collagen in general is relatively safe because it's in food. It's like the amount you eat in the peptides is not that different from if you eat a lot of, let's say, chicken or chicken skin. So yeah, I think it's compared to other supplements, it's probably less risky, but there's always that risk with them.
Yeah. And can I just say about biotin? I work usually in cardiovascular department as a nurse, and I was so surprised with biotin when it comes to inhibiting the true levels of troponin, which is the heart muscle enzyme that's released after injury. I was like, whoa, some of these vitamins and supplements really are not benign at all. It's so interesting.
Yeah, I think it's also that whole like thing where we assume if it's natural, it's safe, and supplements seem more natural than like actual medications, but actual medications are so much better regulated, so much better tested. I don't know if you've come across this like personally, but in Australia, we've had like, okay, there's been like B6 supplements and people's fingers were tingling and they were having nerve damage. And then I've also seen like liver damage from supplements, like green tea supplements. I don't know if you've like,
yeah, definitely. I feel like especially within the recent years, I think ChatGPT came out and Dr. Google became on the rise. I think most of our patients have been, especially with the whole healthcare system here in the United States, where it's so hard to find a specialist. I mean, it's even saddened to say that even our cardiologists, they're booked until December of 2026, right? So obviously, if a patient has a question, the most accessible thing is Dr. Google and Dr. ChatGPT, right? And I guess with all of this articles coming out, and especially the current climate here in the United States, I think the direction of most of these patients is away from pharmaceuticals and more into supplements and vitamins. And I guess because of that, as we know, vitamins or supplements are not as tested as, I guess, pharmaceutical drugs, right? So I guess it's now we're really seeing even effects that we didn't know of that's coming out of this vitamin. So we're always like, oh my goodness, could it, you know, when a patient presents with a new symptom and there's nothing that changed in their cardiac condition and their medical condition, but the only thing that changed that one vitamin that they added to their regimen, we're like, how likely is it that it's from this, right? It's so interesting to think about. And the other thing I wanted to ask when it comes to, I guess, more natural stuff is this thing that I've been seeing in a lot of skincare products too is bakuchiol. It's from a plant. And I guess because it's from a plant, there's a movement towards, oh yeah, this is better than those drying, skin-thinning retinoids, right? What is bakuchiol? And is it really an effective retinoid alternative, or if it's an alternative at all?
Yeah, this is one of the ingredients that really annoys me. From what I've heard, some of the big retailers were pushing this. And so a whole bunch of brands were putting out bakuchiol products for a while and calling them retinout, like retin alternative. There was a study. There's always a study. It was by the ingredient company that was trying to sell bakuchiol. They compared retinol and bakuchiol and they said it was similar. But looking at the data, it really isn't. So they work in different ways. They work at different receptors. If you squint, the structures look kind of similar, but they're not actually like chemically similar. They won't interact at the same places. And yet, like in the study, they used bakuchiol twice a day versus retinol once a day. And then they found similar results, except like it's not that convincing. Like statistically, it just like very roughly looks kind of similar, but they could also not be. But yeah, basically bakuchiol, first off, it's not actually pregnancy safe. Like it's never been tested on pregnant people. Like that's just not something that gets tested. So they could really be sued for it, I think, if they're making pregnancy safe claims, from what I've been told by cosmetic like lawyers who work in this area. But also like retinol itself is also natural. Like it's vitamin A, it's in things like eggs, it's in liver. Retinol is not really pregnancy unsafe either. Based on the calculations, the amount that you get from skincare is less than the amount you get from food. Like not that much goes that deep into your skin and into your blood. So yeah, in Australia, I think most of the time it's really doctors trying to be more cautious and not be sued. But in Australia, we do actually have, like, my local health department has said cosmetic skincare products are fine in pregnancy, which is what the evidence shows. In terms of the results, in that study, Bacuchiol actually caused more redness than retinol. I think retinol caused slightly more irritation. So it's not like it's completely that fine. In terms of effects, is it really an alternative? I would say it's just been marketed really well, because if you look at other products that do cause similar end effects, things like glycolic acid, vitamin C, like they're never marketed as retinol alternatives, but I would say if you applied the same criteria, they would also be retinol alternatives. So yeah, I think it's a really hyped up product that doesn't really have that much to back it up. It has more than a lot of other ingredients though, so I think there's nothing wrong with adding it to your routine, but I would not say if you're looking for something that works as well as retinol, this would be like a direct substitute.
What if your night out could come with a smarter tomorrow? Meet Dayguard, a Korean-inspired functional jelly stick designed to support liver health, hydration, gut balance, and vitamin replenishment when drinking alcohol. With science-backed ingredients like DHM, L-cysteine, prickly pear extract, L-arginine, and B vitamins, each convenient and delicious stick helps your body break down alcohol and reduce next day sluggishness. Just take one stick before your first drink of the night and support your body's natural recovery so you can wake up refreshed. Get 10% off your first purchase at dayguard.com, that's dayguard.com, with the code FRANZ, that's FRANZ. One time use and cannot be combined with other codes. What if your home could feel more like you? Meet Emmy, a New York-based home fragrance brand founded in 2020 by Erica and Mark. Inspired by the scents they grew up with, like steamed rice, tropical fruits, and temple incense, Emmy celebrates fragrance as memory, culture, and ritual. From design-forward candles to reed diffusers and hand soaps, each product is crafted with clean ingredients, wood wicks, and thoughtful formulations. More than scent, Emmy creates atmosphere and belonging, storytelling in wax, in water, in air. So whether it's lighting a candle or washing your hands, small rituals are transformed into something intentional, making your space warm, alive, and entirely yours. Get 15% off at emmynyc.com. That's emmynyc.com with code FRANZ. That's FRANZ. Find your story, find your atmosphere, find it with Emmy.
You know, we've talked a lot about benzene and bakuchiol and collagen and all this marketing buzzwords. So I wanted to take you up for a game. The first part is a this or that. I just want to hear which one you would prefer. It's up to you if you want to explain it or not, or you can just leave it as is, period. Are you ready?
Yes.
Micellar water or oil cleanser?
That's really hard. Why did you start with that one? I would say, okay, if I had to only pick one, oil cleanser, but it has to be one that doesn't sting my eyes so I can get waterproof eye makeup off, because micellar water doesn't work that well for me, for my eyes. Yep.
I guess it's not just me. Each time I use micellar water, I'm like, I think I'm going to go blind. What's going on?
I feel like it just doesn't get the eye stuff off. Like, it's fine if I wipe it over quickly, but like to get it off, like you have to hold it and like wait and too much.
What's your thoughts on people putting it on the Q-tip and like dabbing it under? Have you seen that? They would dab it on their eyes.
No, but I think that would be fine. It's just, I don't know how well it works. Like I've tried to use it when I've like messed up my eyeliner to like erase it and it, like you have to, I have to rub quite a bit. Maybe my eyeliner is just too good, but
Gosh, tanning bed or tanning spray?
Tanning spray for sure. Tanning beds are so bad for you.
Gel manicure or acrylics?
Oh, that's hard. Never actually had acrylics. So I would have to say gel, I guess. But if someone else is doing them, do my acrylics, please.
HA or BHA?
BHA, these are hard.
Face wash or bar soap?
Face wash. It's got to be face wash.
Hair blow dryer or Air dry.
Air dry because I'm lazy.
Okay. Me too. For a breakout, a steroid shot or a benzoyl peroxide spot treatment?
If I don't have to pay for them, steroid shot.
Okay, for brightening, vitamin C or niacinamide?
Depends on the product. Both?
Both?
Can we put them both in the one
okay,
product?
Okay, I'll give you one pass for both. And last one for this round, for calming, aloe vera or centella asiatica?
Centella. I feel like aloe vera is so overrated, but it's like overrated in a 90s way. Like, I don't think anyone cares about it anymore.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I wanted to ask because I feel like when I think of soothing or calming, the first thing I think of probably because, you know, growing up, I mean, I was like aloe vera for if you have like a sunburn or whatnot, right? People aloe vera. I guess if I can harp on the question, is there anything other than centella that you would recommend? You would say based on data when it comes to calming and soothing?
Oh, so my friend Hannah English, she has this serum that she basically, I asked her this at some point, pretty much the same question. And she was like, it's every ingredient I put in my serum.
Yeah, not to plug.
Or maybe to plug because it is actually really good. I actually really like it. It's the TVH Skincare Rebound Serum. Mm-hmm. Trying to remember all the stuff she put in it, but I think she put oat. I think she put copper peptide maybe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, basically that is like the cheat sheet for ingredients that might help. The problem with those ingredients though is a lot of them are very, they're natural, which means like different, if even with centella, if you get centella from one brand versus another, it might not have the same concentration of the active ingredients. So there's one called Magic Cassicide, which is in the La Roche-Posay Sika Plus Balm. And it's in there as Magic Cassicide because, yeah, centella, it's so much harder to control. I think they might have added centella as well, but that's just the easier way to control it. Yeah, natural things, it's always like a bit of a crapshoot. I think licorice is also quite good. That's quite popular in a lot of Asian products. Oatmeal, but with oatmeal, like that's a common allergy as well. And it's not all oatmeal products have the same. I think Aveeno, though, is based on the specific ingredient in oats, which is avenanthramides, I think is the name. But yeah.
I see. Well, that was a good this or that round. Our last game. So I found out in Australia that there's a slang term called yeah, nah, or nah. Yeah, which I guess yeah, nah means no, and nah, yeah means yes. So whatever the last word is, I was like, is there a yay or nay for Australians? And that's what I found. So I'm gonna give you 7 different things, whether it's an ingredient or a product or a statement, and you're just gonna say yeah, nah if it's a no from you, or nah, yeah if it's a yes from you. Ready?
Yes. Well, nah, yeah.
Nah, yeah. Okay, number one, Riedel shot.
Nah, yeah.
Yeah? It's a yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know. It's a mixed one, but I would say, yeah, just don't rub it too hard.
I see. Rose water toners.
Yeah, nah. Unless you like the smell, in which case, you know, you do you.
I can't deal with the smell of rose in skincare. I don't know if it's just me. I think it's too strong for me. Or maybe the ones here in America are. How about this? J-Lo's olive oil in skincare.
Yeah, nah. She gets Botox and lots of other procedures. Probably, allegedly.
Allegedly. How about this? Red light therapy.
Nah, yeah. This one's controversial. I know a lot of scientists think it's bunk, but I think it does something.
How about blue light therapy?
Yeah, nah, for me, for any skin that produces pigment. But if your skin is very pale, then if you want to get rid of acne.
Rosemary oil helps with hair loss.
Yeah, nah.
Okay. Eating chocolate can cause acne.
Oh, yeah.
Mm.
Oh, it depends for some people. For some people.
Mm, yeah, for some people. And the last one, I'm curious. Eye creams.
Nah, yeah, for some people. Like, it's not necessary, but, like, if you do get clogged pores around your eyes, if you get milia, if you want to not use a product all over your face, like, if you want to use, like, more concentrated actives there, then yeah, but otherwise, it's not mandatory.
Mm, I love the answer. Well, you know, we've talked a lot about today, and I think it goes to show that the world of beauty, skincare, and cosmetics can be overwhelming. I mean, there's like, I feel like there's a new product out every single week. There's a new celebrity skincare line every single month. And I guess, you know, the news of like formulation updates or even reports that came out, and definitely fear-mongering online, whether it's social media or Reddit forums, again, almost every week, almost every month. I guess through all of your experience and, you know, all of the knowledge that you have in this field and all the data that we have, I guess what's your advice for anyone about to start their skincare or makeup routine journey for the very first time, but maybe overwhelmed by the amount of information out there?
I'd say number one, if you see something scary, don't throw out your product, put it to the side. Don't chuck it out. Yeah, just put it to the side. Maybe pause using it for a bit. Yeah, because I've heard so many people say, like, I saw this thing and I threw everything out and now I have to buy everything again. And like, I don't know, Asian immigrant upbringing, like, yep. Don't throw stuff out. Like, don't waste stuff. Number two, I guess, like, don't get swept up in the hype. Like, write down what you need. Like, write down what skin concerns you have, what skin type you have, if you want to deal with brightening. So you don't like go online and you hear someone like rave about something that's great for, you know, crow's feet. And you're like, mm-hmm. Oh, I need that. And it's like, you don't have crow's feet. Mm-hmm. You've never had crow's feet until, you never thought about crow's feet until you saw this video. Yeah. So write that down and stick to it. Check it before you go buy stuff. Add one product in at a time so that you can see what is actually working. And if something breaks you out, you know exactly which product isn't. Like, leave 2 weeks between new products. It's really tempting to slap it all on, but it's like you end up with a really complex routine and you don't know how to cut it down. And now you're like buying 30 products a month. Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of the time, if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is. Yeah.
And for me personally, I think another tip is to read The Science of Beauty.
Yes, of course.
Honestly.
Thank you.
A holy grail. Each time someone asks me a skincare question, I literally just send them the Amazon link. And I'm like, just do it. Dr. Wong, this is such a great conversation. I learned so much and I just loved everything that we talked about. And I just want to say thank you because personally, you bring so much light to the world of skincare and beauty. You know, because of my acne years ago, I was always scared of the field of beauty and cosmetics because I feel like there was no product that was right for me. And I think I fall into a hole of just fear of, what if this will break me out? What if this will make me allergic? What if this will make it come back? And it's so amazing that nowadays we have people like you online who helps shine light on, I guess, what is true, what is tested, and just calms down that fear and I guess brings more hope and reassurance for everyone. So thank you so much for all that you do.
Thank you. That is so lovely to hear. I'm so glad I could help.
Yeah. Thank you, Dr. Wong.
Thank you.